Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Annette Bosworth Appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Dana Hanna, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the State of South Dakota, we have Mr. Paul Swedlin, Assistant Attorney General from Pierre. Mr. Hanna, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the State Supreme Court.
Why don't you take your water up with you?
Thank you, sir.
Okay. That's a good idea.
We don't want to make this an endurance test.
May it please the court. I'm Dana Hanna from Rapid City, and it is my privilege to represent Dr. Annette Bosworth, the appellant in this action. With your permission, I would like to begin by discussing why the six voters nominating petitions in this case are not false instruments under the statute, in spite of the fact that they each contain a factually false statement signed by Dr. Bosworth that she had witnessed the signing of those signatures. This is a question of law that this court will review de novo. In order to be a false instrument under the statute, it is not enough that a document contain a lie. The document itself must be a lie.
So if any part of it's accurate, you're saying it doesn't violate the law?
I'm sorry, Judge?
If any part of the document is accurate or not a lie, you're saying the document itself is okay.
That's not exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that a false statement on a collateral immaterial fact that
like
does
swearing?
Not strip the document of all legal authority means that the document is a genuine document. It is not a false document. The general question of law that the court will have to answer is, does a false statement in a legal document make that document a false instrument under 2211.28.1? The answer is yes, if the false statement makes the document itself a counterfeit, a fraud, a lie, if it strips it of all legal authority. For example, in the Hayes case from 100 years ago, that was a forgery case, the defendant falsely created a certificate of deposit that said somebody deposited $2,000 in this bank. Totally false. It rendered the entire document false. A fraud, stripped it of legal authority. Similarly, in the Generis case, California case cited by the state in its brief, it was a deed. The person said, I own this land and I convey it to so-and-so. They did not own the land. That single false statement rendered the entire document a fraud.
But isn't that different because there's only one statement involving one issue, in other words, a deposit in a bank. That's different than a petition here, where there's issues about, did somebody really sign it? Did somebody really circulate it? There's a number of factual matters contained in that.
And the
petition, as I understand it, has valid signatures on it. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I'm not following what you're saying.
All right. The false verification, I witnessed these signatures, does not strip these petitions of legal authority. They do not prevent the Secretary of State from counting those signatures because they are on a collateral matter. If the false statement is on a collateral immaterial matter...
Stop right there.
Okay.
Who says the verification is a immaterial.
This court stated that in Kuhn versus Morrison, that the Secretary of State is limited to looking at the face of the document. The Secretary of State, in deciding whether or not to count the signatures, cannot, has no authority to look beyond the face of the document to determine whether the statements are true or not. And that was exactly the testimony of the state's expert, former Secretary of State, Chris Nelson. He was asked, what is the duty of the Secretary of State? I look at the face of the document to see whether it is properly completed, not whether it is true. And this is quoted in my brief. He is specifically asked, does it matter to you? Do you ask whether or not the verification is true or not? He said, no. We have no authority to ask that question. Whether or not these signatures get counted by the Secretary of State is totally dependent on what is on the face of the document. Now, if the verification were missing, Justice Sabres, if it was missing, then that petition could not be counted. But the test is, in spite of the false statements that she had witnessed these signatures, do these petitions nevertheless retain the legal authority to induce the Secretary of State to count these signatures? And the answer is yes. Now, the prosecutor, the Attorney General, says this false statement invalidates the whole petition. So the question I would put to him is, who says? Where does it say that? What law do you have to support that?
But that's not the issue in this case, is it? I mean, the issue is whether or not there's perjury.
That's another issue, and I will deal with that, Your Honor. But this is dealing with the filing of false instruments. Is this a false or forged instrument under the statute? And I want to clear up something that is mischaracterized in the Attorney General's argument. I am not saying that in order to be a false instrument, a document has to be forged. I am not saying that. I have never said that. But according to the statute, the statutory rule of construction, if two words are coupled in a statute, that denotes a legislative intent that they mean similar things. A false document, a false instrument, is like a forged instrument in that it is utterly devoid of legal authority.
We have a disjunctive, false or forged, meaning
correct.
Two separate matters.
Absolutely.
Needing separate review. You would agree with that?
Absolutely. They are two separate things, as I have stated in my brief. The only case in which this court has ever looked at this particular statute is, of course, the Paulson case. And I think that case kind of hit it on the head when it said, this is a false instrument because it is devoid of legal authority. It appears to have the authority to induce someone to act, but it has none. That was not a forgery. Paulson signed those phony documents with his own name. But they were false because they had no legal authority. Now, these petitions, the signatures in them were counted properly because the Secretary of State cannot and does not look behind the face of the document to say, did she really view these signatures or not? It is immaterial to the question of whether or not the Secretary of State is going to count those signatures. The error in the state's argument can be seen in the final pages of their appellee's brief, in which they state that In deciding whether or not to count the signatures, the Secretary of State, quote, adjudicates the legitimacy of the petition. Absolutely 100% incorrect. The Secretary of State doesn't adjudicate anything. As this court stated in Kuhn versus Morrison, and as former Secretary of State Nelson testified, the duty of the Secretary of State in determining whether to count signatures in the signature validation process is strictly ministerial. He has no authority to look beyond the face. The statute that the Attorney General, well, it's not a statute, it's a rule, is relying on to say that this false statement in the verification invalidated the petitions is the administrative rule that says a petition is not going to be counted if the verification of the circulator is not completed or is improperly completed according to Administrative Rule 5.02.08.003 in parentheses. They don't ask whether or not it's true. The Secretary of State asks, is it complete? Does it follow the requirements on its face? They simply do not ask whether or not it's true or not. So we don't get around to that question. It is an immaterial question, and that is why it does not render these petitions false documents. I'd like to address your point, Justice. You asked about perjury. My first argument, of course, is that the perjury convictions also have to be overturned because this statement, false though it was not made in a state or federal proceeding or action under the statute. Again, this is a matter of statutory interpretation. There's a question de novo. It is not for an appellate court to try to figure out the farthest reaches or application of what a statutory language might mean in the abstract. Obviously, as you know far better than I, it's a question of what did the legislature intend these words to mean? And in this case, that's not a hard question because they define it in the statutes. Proceeding and action are defined in other statutes. And we have a statute, as well as State against San Real, that says this court is bound by a statutory definition of a statutory term. It is not defined in the perjury statute. Proceeding or action is not defined in the perjury statute, but they are defined in other statutes that proceeding is an adjudicative proceeding, a legal or a judicial or administrative or arbitral adjudicative process of proceeding. This court is bound by that. The Attorney General did not even address that argument.
So you're saying basically short of a person coming into a proceeding where you're under oath, just filing a paper could never constitute perjury under this statute.
No, sir, that's not exactly what I'm saying. Filing a paper such as an interrogatory or an affidavit that is connected to a judicial or quasi-judicial proceeding would be perjury. But unless it may be a violation of another statute to file a false document, and I've listed many in my brief, but it's not perjury. It was not intended to be perjury.
So what do you make of the amendment, the change to the statute that was made in 2002?
The takes it from cases to proceeding or action?
Yes.
So yeah,
Expanded beyond cases.
Yeah, they expanded it beyond cases because to make it clear that that could also refer to an adjudicative process or some kind of quasi-judicial process or a legislative process. But there has to be a proceeding or action. The legislature intended this to be some kind of adjudicative process or proceeding. That's also demonstrated from the fact that these words proceeding and action are legal terms of art that have recognized meanings in the law, and we have every reason to believe that's what the legislature intended them to mean. Even more obvious, they defined those words. And the statute says if a term is defined in other statutes, is binding unless a contrary intention clearly appears, and the Attorney General has not presented any evidence of a contrary intention that these words should mean anything other than what they mean in other statutes, which specifically define a proceeding as an adjudicative proceeding related to a judicial or quasi-judicial proceeding.
If I recall, though, those statutes are in chapters of the code unrelated to criminal perjury.
I agree. So, I mean, nevertheless, they are statutes that define those terms.
We have in other cases rejected that argument where the chapters really don't relate to each other.
Then I would go back to the basic argument that these are terms of art with recognized meanings in the law. Moreover, the judge instructed the jury in terms of what that means, and I would say that it doesn't mean the far-out application given by the Attorney General. The Attorney General says this is a proceeding, a document in which people nominate a candidate is a proceeding under the statute. I do not believe there is anything to support that in the language of the statute. Or comparison with other statutes. It is...
About the term, though, speaking of terms, I mean, when the legislature changed this law, they added the word certify truly. Now, if it's got to be an adjudicative proceeding, that doesn't really make sense to be certifying. Certifying seems to be exactly what happened here.
I disagree, because a document can be certified within a judicial or quasi-judicial proceeding, such as an interrogatory, just a sworn statement that's filed in court. But it has to be connected.
What's being certified there? When you sign something in an adjudicated proceeding, are you certifying or are you? I don't follow what you're saying there.
Well, I think the language of the statute in terms of perjury, referring to a statement made in a state or federal proceeding or action, refers to just that, a judicial, the commonly understood meaning of those terms. As terms of art. It's not just any legal document that gets filed.
Isn't, though, the first sentence where it talks about before any competent tribunal, officer, or person in any proceeding, doesn't that expand it? And clearly a notary public is an officer, a state officer.
That's true, but not every document signed in front of a notary public would constitute perjury if the statement under this statute, if the statement is false. It still has to be within a proceeding or action. There's plenty of statutes, and I cite them in my brief, that make a false statement in a document a crime, including other kinds of perjury, statutory forms of perjury. None of those statutes would even be necessary if filing any document under seal was perjury. I think this is intended to be limited to proceedings in which the fact-finding integrity of an adjudicative process is at issue. And I think that's what the legislature intended. I just do not think there's any support for the far expansive definition that the Attorney General would put on perjury. It would vastly expand the intent of the legislature in terms of the reach of this particular law. The comparison of other with other statutes also, I believe, supports that. I believe my time is up.
It is.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hamm. Mr. Swedlin, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. In 2014, Annette Bosworth threw her hat in the political ring to campaign for the Republican nomination for a seat in the United States Senate. Fearing she might not have sufficient signatures to qualify for her name on the primary ballot, against the advice of her counsel, Bosworth signed 6 nominating petitions in which she falsely swore under oath that she had personally circulated the subject petitions and witnessed the signatures of the ostensible voters who had signed them. In fact, she had been in the Philippines when the petitions were circulated by other people. Through her campaign staff, Bosworth filed the petitions with the Secretary of State. Bosworth was subsequently charged and convicted of 6 counts of perjury and 6 counts of filing a false instrument. Bosworth first argues in this appeal that the Secretary of State's process of her petitions is not a proceeding or action within the meaning of the perjury statute. According to Bosworth, proceeding or action are terms of art describing strictly judicial or quasi-judicial proceedings. It's important to note that Bosworth did not make this particular form of her argument below. Below, she argued that the terms proceeding or action were vague and so should be interpreted according to their common everyday meanings. But having lost that argument, Bosworth now makes the exact opposite argument. The terms are not vague, they are rather definitionally precise. The terms are not common everyday words, but they are in fact terms of art of a specialized profession.
What would be your view then of counsel's comment that they are defined in other chapters in the code?
Well, as Justice Zinner points out, and those statutes, actually in the statutes themselves, very explicitly say that the definitions apply to strictly the chapter or title in which those particular definitions are found.
So that's how you would distinguish SDCL 214.4, which says basically that if it's used anywhere in the code, it applies in the entire code unless the opposite appears plainly from the statute.
I would. For example, in 1913A27, it does specifically say right there in the statute, as used in this chapter, proceeding means this. And so this is not within, this statute in question is not within that same chapter. But even if we look at 1913A27, we find that it defines proceeding to include administrative process. So this court then, rather than looking at
this... Well, that's one of the questions. Is this an administrative... this is filed before the Secretary of State, or with the Secretary of State, a constitutional officer, and the forms are prescribed by an administrative body. Are we dealing with an administrative proceeding?
Well,
filing with a constitutional officer?
What we're looking at here, so we look at the definition of proceeding in Black's Law Dictionary. It says that, it talks about right here the particular sense of the word in any application to a court of justice, but then it also describes other less particular senses of the word, which the term, it says, the term also refers to administrative proceedings before agencies, tribunals, bureaus, and the like. It says it is an act which is done by the authority or the direction of the court, agency, or tribunal. It says that an act necessary to be done in order to obtain a given end is a proceeding, a prescribed mode of action for carrying out or carrying into effect a legal right is a proceeding. So when we look at Black's Law Dictionary, it takes, even as a term of art, even if we accept that Black's that proceeding is a term of art here, Black's Law Dictionary itself does not confine the meaning of proceeding to the particular sense of a judicial case. This court interprets statutes in accord with the legislative intent. And the legislative intent is derived from the plain, ordinary, and popular meanings of statutory language. This court assumes the legislature meant what the statute says and therefore gives its words and phrases a plain meaning and effect. And that's McIntyre versus Wick. So the process involved here is you have an agency. The agency, first of all, opens its doors. It mans the counter. The people at the counter accept the petition from Ms. Bosworth. They look at the petition. They examine it to see if on its face they can file it or not. They make then the decision to file it, and then they subsequently make a decision whether the person should be placed on the ballot or not. That entails process or proceedings within an agency. It entails, quote, an act necessary to be done in order to obtain a given end or a prescribed mode of action for carrying into effect a legal right as defined in Black's. Bosworth next argues that an instrument is not false within the meaning of 2211.28.1 unless it is devoid of legal authority on its face. In other words, according to Bosworth, her success in disguising the defects in her petition and duping the Secretary of the State into accepting them somehow makes them valid, which is like saying that a store or bank's acceptance of a counterfeit bill makes the bill valid. The Secretary's acceptance does not transform Bosworth's invalid petitions or inauthentic petitions into valid ones. It just means that their inauthenticity has not yet been detected by the process. Burns versus Kurtenbach says as much. In Burns, the school district business manager accepted nominating petitions from two candidates for school board who had left the circulation verification sections blank. When the candidate's election to the school board was subsequently challenged, the candidates retrieved the petitions back from the business manager and signed and backdated the verification sections to the date that they were filed. Burns ruled that the business manager's initial acceptance of the petitions did not magically transform those petitions into valid petitions. And Burns sensibly condemned the candidates' backdating shenanigans, saying, apropos of this case, no one is authorized by law to doctor up a sick petition. Likewise, Dr. Bosworth could not cure her sick petitions by pretending to be the circulator when she was not. Nor does the agency's unwitting acceptance of invalid petitions affect a remedy. But even if we accept Dr. Bosworth's logic that an instrument is false only if it's inherently invalid, ARSD 52801B provides that a petition is invalid if the circulator's verification is improperly completed according to ARSD 52803.
That's not what happened here. It was completed.
Well, it has to be completed in terms of 52803. And 52803 provides that a petition is valid only if verified by the circulator. Well, Bosworth was not the circulator. So that pretty much ends her argument that the petition sheets were somehow valid and therefore genuine under 2211.28.1.
What is the underlying purpose of the verification?
The underlying purpose of the verification is to represent to the Secretary of State that the people who signed as voters were real people. So unlike in this case, we actually have a situation where the purpose of the verification was frustrated because we have something like 12 or 13 forged signatures of voters who were not real and who did not actually sign the petition. So not only do we have the frustration and the purpose of having the having the petition signed under oath by the circulator, we also have the very evil that that oath was designed to protect against, which is the filing of circulation petitions that are not signed by actual voters.
You know, Mr. Hanna has a valid point, I think, on comparing and contrasting the Paulson case. There, the document is utterly false. And here you have valid signatures by registered voters who signed a petition for election that was filed. So, I mean, it's hard to say that the petition itself is false. It's a nominating petition.
It certainly is. However, for that petition to be valid, it must conform to the administrative regulations.
But how do you distinguish, like the Paulson case, where the document's utterly false?
I wouldn't distinguish it. I would simply say that there's more than one form of a false document under the statute. It can take different forms. It can be an outwardly authentic appearing document, or it can be one that, once you look closely at it, is not outwardly authentic, such as in Paulson. The statute's broad enough to encompass both, which makes Bosworth's reliance on the Jones case from Arizona somewhat misplaced here. Jones.
That was my next question. I want you to address Jones.
Okay, well, Jones did not reach the question here of whether the false instrument statute, quote, was implicated because the false verifications rendered the petitions void. Here, however, the state did assert below that Bosworth's petitions were void and therefore false and therefore not genuine within the meaning of the false instrument statute. And even to the extent that Jones did address in dicta the effect of an improper verification, it stated that, quote, a petition is void if it is verified by someone other than the one who actually obtained the signatures, end quote. So Bosworth's own authority does not support her position that these petitions were valid simply because she snuck them past the Secretary of State. Burns says much the same. It found that, quote, the absence of a properly completed circulator's verification rendered the nominating petitions invalid, end quote.
If these administrative rules that you've referred to did not exist and we were looking just at the statutes, would you still have a crime here?
I believe we would, yes, Your Honor. I think the administrative rules amplify the statute and let the court know exactly what behavior and let the public know exactly what behavior is expected of somebody that's submitting a nominating petition.
Well, it's my understanding that the legislature defines criminal acts in this state, and I guess what I'm asking is, are you dependent on these administrative regulations to support a felony conviction here?
I don't think...
If you violate the administrative rules, it may invalidate the petition, but does that also constitute a felony?
Well, if we look to the statute, we see that the operative language is any person who offers any false instrument, knowing the instrument is false, for filing in a public office, which instrument, if genuine, could be filed. Well, we know that even under the processes that are prescribed, This is a mere presumptive validity that is attached to petitions once they're filed. They can be challenged later, but this presumptive validity does not mean that they are, in fact, genuine documents and genuine instruments. Here we have somebody who signed who did not circulate. So if you look at the circulating petitions themselves, it says, I swear that I circulated this petition. And that's a false statement. It makes the document non-genuine because the person who did circulate the petition is the one who has to sign it.
I guess my question is, Burns versus Kurtenbach is a civil proceeding challenging the validity of an election. This is a criminal conviction. There's clearly a difference.
I'd say there's a difference, yes, but if we want to look purely at the statute, swearing to something that is not true, swearing that you were the circulator when you were not, when the document requires that it be the circulator who signs it, That renders the document not genuine. So they were not genuine by virtue of the fact that they were not signed by the actual circulator. And even if Bosworth's false oath made them appear valid on their face. And this is the essential findings of Hayes and Reeser and Shilbach-Havard. Those are criminal cases. And all three of those cases found that the false instrument statute was implicated by documents that were outwardly and in every respect authentic, except for the false statements contained within them. Here, Bosworth did not circulate the subject petitions, as she said. They were void ab initio. She concealed that voidness behind a false oath, and the fact that she duped the Secretary of State into accepting them is the very essence of passing a counterfeit instrument, not a defense for it. Therefore, the trial court did not err in denying Bosworth's judgment of acquittal. Finally, Bosworth argues that she did not offer the petitions to be filed with the Secretary of State because they were filed by her staff and not her personally. And this very argument was rejected in People v. Frieda, which is 817 Pacific 2nd 588, Colorado Appellate Division 5, 1991. It's not cited in my brief, but I did provide it to opposing counsel.
Then under our court rules, you provide, I believe, 10 copies to the court. Is that correct, Shirley?
Yes.
I did not do that, but I did provide it to
Mr.
Well,
you're allowed
Hannah.
To do that after the fact.
Okay.
But we'd like to read it, too.
Okay, I will do that. In Frieda, a psychiatrist was convicted of offering false billing statements to Medicaid. The psychiatrist had instructed his billing service to bill Medicaid for individual therapy sessions for patients who had actually participated in less costly group therapy sessions. And like Bosworth, the psychiatrist argued that he had not offered the false billing statements because he did not personally submit the forms to Medicaid. And the Frieda court sensibly rejected such literalism. Frieda found that the interposition of the psychiatrist's billing service to submit the bills to Medicaid on his behalf did not insulate him from criminal liability because he knew the bills contained false statements and the billing service was acting at his direction. So as in the Frieda case, the evidence here is sufficient to prove that Bosworth offered the subject petitions. Bosworth's campaign counsel told her she could not sign the petitions she had not circulated. "I can't be more clear," he said. So Bosworth knew her oaths were false. She directed her staff to file the petitions anyway. And afterwards, these staff members texted Bosworth to tell her that, quote, "her request was fulfilled," end quote. And she, as she alone, benefited from the filing with the Secretary of State. Bosworth's interpretation of 2211.28.1 would too easily defeat the statute's purpose. It would allow the dishonest people to circumvent the statute by dispatching intermediaries to file their false instruments in public offices. This hyper-literal interpretation was rejected in the Frieda case and should be rejected here. For the reasons stated here and in the court in the state's briefing, the state would ask that Bosworth's convictions be affirmed.
I have a question. If the court reverses and remands this case, would it be for a retrial or would it be an outright dismissal?
Be for a retrial, Your Honor.
Okay. Any other questions from the court? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hanna, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. First, to address the Attorney General's argument that I did not make this motion or this argument below. I did, in fact, make this very argument below. It's in the brief and motion that is attached to my reply brief. Dealing with the question that was just raised by the State Attorney General about the question of whether the evidence is insufficient to convict for filing a false instrument because the evidence is undisputed, she did not file a false instrument. Here's what happened in this case. In the grand jury, they had a witness who worked in the Secretary of State's office, who said Annette Bosworth personally walked into this office and filed a stack of petitions, and she was indicted for that. At trial, that witness recanted her testimony. She said Annette Bosworth never showed up in that Secretary of State's office. She was not there. Somebody else from her campaign that did that. But the Attorney General, although they changed the theory of their prosecution, never asked the court to instruct the jury on the law regarding vicarious criminal liability. They went from she directly did this to she should be held guilty for an act committed by another. Now, of course, one can be found guilty for an act committed by another. But that was not the instruction that the court gave the jury. The court instructed the jury to find the defendant guilty. You have to find that she filed those documents.
Did you object to that instruction?
No, sir, I did not. And the prosecutor is wrong when he says that I am objecting to the instructions. I'm fine with the instructions, Judge. I love this instruction because under this instruction, when the jury follows it, my client is entitled to a verdict of not guilty because the evidence is absolutely clear. She did not file anything. Now, if they had proceeded the way they should have proceeded, they would have asked the court, please instruct the jury that you can find the defendant guilty for an act committed by another if you find that the following facts are proven. The defendant instructed an agent to file these documents. The defendant did so knowing that the documents were false and that the agent did so acting on her behalf. That instruction was never given to the jury. And, Judge, it is not for me. It is not for defense counsel to ask the judge to instruct the jury on the prosecutor's theory of defense. That would be totally inconsistent with my duties as a defense counsel. That is the attorney general's job, and they blew it, frankly. They dropped the ball. They did not ask the judge to instruct the jury. And the statute in this case, in this state, says juries are bound by the instruction the law has given to them by the court. The court instructed them that they had to find that Annette Bosworth filed these petitions, and I'm fine with that instruction because the evidence is undisputed she did not. If this court were to affirm, frankly, with all due respect, the only way this court could affirm the convictions on this point would be by acting as finders of fact. If you instruct yourself as this is what the state has to prove to find her guilty of an act committed by another, and we find that they have proven that, you're acting as finders of fact. You are usurping the jury's duty. The jury was... they were given the instruction they were given. They were not given the instruction that they should have been given by the Attorney General. Had they been given that instruction, the evidence would be sufficient. But they were not given that instruction. They're bound by the instruction they were given, and that's another reason why this court should overturn the conviction and find that the evidence was insufficient for that.
Are you suggesting that it be sent back for retrial on appropriate instructions?
No, Your Honor. My belief is that if you reverse, you have to just dismiss the case. I don't believe this goes back for a retrial on any... it's not a matter of... an error in the process in terms of bad evidence coming in. The evidence is simply insufficient as a matter of law on all 12 convictions here.
You don't argue here that the law of vicarious liability applies to what happened here.
I believe it would apply, Justice Inters. And I believe that if they had been instructed correctly on the law of vicarious criminal liability, I would not be up here arguing that the evidence is insufficient. But that jury was not asked, do you find that
somebody else was acting on her behalf. They never made that decision because they weren't asked that question. They weren't instructed on it. So yes, it would apply. Had they been properly instructed, it would be a different case. But they were not properly instructed, and that's why the evidence is insufficient. A good point was raised in a question to the Attorney General, which is, what is the purpose of this requirement for a verification by the circulator? It's to make sure that those are real signatures. And but for one petition here, each of the six petitions contained real signatures. One contained about 11 that weren't. But all of the contained some real signatures. And the voters' right to participate in the electoral process is an important value here. That should not be squashed by an error by the person who signed the circulator's petition, factually incorrect.
Isn't the verification, though, also important to the very integrity of the democratic process?
It is.
Especially knowing that the Secretary of State is going to do what you've described as a facial review.
Judge, it is important. I'm not going to say it's not important. But, and I know there's a sense that if she did something wrong, if she did something deliberately false, that there has to be a punishment for that. I agree with that. But that punishment doesn't involve felony conviction for a crime that is not covered by this. The punishment is in the process, and it worked here. It became public. This became a public issue. And arguments were made, much like the Attorney General made in his brief, which is somebody who willfully makes a false statement on a petition like this does not deserve public office. I'm not going to debate about that. That may very well be a sound position to make. But this became a public issue in her campaign, and it derailed her campaign. It became a public issue that she had made a false statement in this verification, and it consumed the rest of her campaign. That argument needs to be made to the electors, and it was. So, yes, it's important. And the fact that a statement was made that is factually not true is important, and it became an issue, but it's not a violation of this particular statute. Now, I have to say, out of respect for my client, at trial, she stated, and we argued, this was not an intentional false statement. The jury ruled against it, and I'm not here to argue credibility. But I want to say on behalf of my client that was the record below, and you know, we did not prevail in that defense. But I agree that it is important that if one single signature is counted by the Secretary of State, then that document has some legal authority. It has legal authority to impel the Secretary of State to count the signature. And therefore, it is a genuine document, in spite of the fact that it may contain a factually false statement. And that is why those six convictions should be reversed, as well as the convictions on the perjury charges. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you, Mr. Hanna. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.